Another of the public journalism preachers is Jay Rosen, professor of journalism at New York University. He argues that the newspaper of the future will have to rethink its relationship to all the institutions that nourish public life, from libraries to university to cafes. It will have to do more than cover these institutions when they happen to make news. It will have to do more than print their advertisements. The newspaper must see that its own health is dependent on the health of dozens of other agencies which pull people out of their private worlds. For the greater pull of the public life, the greater the need for the newspaper. Empty streets are bad for editors, despite the wealth of crime news they may generate. The emptier the streets, the emptier the newspaper will seem to the readers barricaded in the private homes. Like the others, Rosen insists that journalism is dying not because of its failure to approach the news in an objective and impartial way, but because of its failure to relate to the common man through social activism. Indeed, Rosen condescendingly lectures that if the public is assumed to be out there, more or less intact, then the job of the press is easy to state: to inform people about what goes on in their name and their midst. But suppose the public leads a more broken existence. At times it may be alert and engaged, but just as often it struggles against other pressures, including itself, that can win out in the end. Inattention to public matters is perhaps the simplest of these, atomization of society one of the more intricate. Money speaks louder than the public, problems overwhelm it, fatigue sets in, attention falters, cynicism swells. A public that leads this more fragile kind of existence suggests a different task for the press, not just to inform a public that may or may not emerge, but to improve the changes that will emerge. John Dewey, an early hero of mine, had suggested something like this in his 1927 book, The Public and Its Problems. With Dewey as his hero, Rosen has spent years teaching his journalism students and promoting to seminarians his ideological approach to reporting. Cloaked in the nomenclature of public or community journalism, said to be without specific rules or form and urging the abandonment of traditional journalism, public journalism has contributed mightily to justifying the near-complete and extensive politicization of the newsroom, where social activism in support of various American Marxist movements has engulfed the former profession of journalism and substituted slanted and biased opinion for news. And Rosen, like Glasser, Merritt, and most of the rest of the media, is further exposed by his open contempt for Trump. Indeed, Trump, as their target, has done more to reveal this radical movement than any other individual possibly could. Writing in the Washington Post during the 2016 presidential election, Rosen asserted, "Imagine a candidate who wants to increase public confusion about where he stands on things, so that voters give up on trying to stay informed and instead vote with raw emotion. Under these conditions, does asking, 'Where do you stand, sir?' serve the goals of journalism, or does it enlist the interviewer in the candidate's chaotic plan? I know what you're thinking, journalists. What do you want us to do, stop covering a major party candidate for president? That would be irresponsible." True, but this reaction short-circuits intelligent debate. Beneath every common practice in election coverage, there are premises about how candidates will behave. I want you to ask, do these still apply? Trump isn't behaving like a normal candidate. He's acting like an unbound one. In response, journalists have to become less predictable themselves. They have to come up with novel responses. They have to do things they have never done. They may even have to shock us. They may need to collaborate, writes Rosen, across news brands in ways they have never known. They may have to call Trump out with a forcefulness unseen before. They may have to risk the breakdown of decorum in interviews and endure excruciating awkwardness. Hardest of all, they will have to explain to the public that Trump is a special case and normal rules do not apply. Clearly, Rosen's instruction was aggressively and relentlessly pursued. Conversely, in reporting on the candidacy of Joe Biden's presidential campaign and now presidency, the public journalism troupe has demonstrated a dramatic turnaround and utter disinterest, even a disciplined incuriosity in its coverage. The media today serve as a Praetorian guard around Biden and his extremely radical agenda, where serious and substantive scrutiny are mostly non-existent. Martin Linsky at the American Prospect, a self-described progressive advocacy magazine and website, cut to the chase. For one thing, the public journalism movement took the cloak of detachment off the emperor. Some press icons finally acknowledged what politicians and bureaucrats and interest groups and citizens have long understood, namely that the media are players in the game of public affairs, not disinterested observers. What they do and how they do it has consequences, whether they want to take responsibility for them or not. Rosen dissects the myth of journalistic detachment. Every story, every decision about what to cover is based on some usually unspoken assumption about how the world is supposed to work. Rosen is surely right when he says that all forms of political journalism rest on a mental picture of how politics and democracy should function. There is nothing detached about it. It must also be the case that assessments of the state of American democracy, including his own, similarly rest on a mental picture of democratic ideals. A story about income inequality, for example, is only a story if there exists in the newsroom a perspective that inequality is bad. That a campaign looks more like a sporting event than an Oxford-Cambridge debate is a cause for hand-wringing only if you think that campaigns were once, or at least should now be, decorous. The combination of propaganda, pseudo-news, and social activism in America's newsrooms has resulted in the disastrous state of the modern press. No longer are there discernible, traditional, or professional standards applied to the reporting of news. Indeed, journalism, such as it is, has come full circle, returning to the approach applied by Marx himself. Again, as Ledbetter explained earlier, Marx's journalism does resemble some of the writing that is published today in journals of opinion, and it's not hard to see a direct line between Marx's journalistic writing and the kind of tendentious writing on public affairs that characterized much political journalism, especially in Europe, in the 20th century. Moreover, Marx's influence goes well beyond his opinion journalism. The American media have become special pleaders for the Marxist ideology, or at least advocates for those who apply it to numerous aspects of society. But the story does not end here. In fact, it gets worse. The next step is the logical progression away from an open and free society, where indoctrination and activism are key to controlling thought and outcomes, ultimately to repression, that is, the silencing of opposition on contrary voices in pursuit of an ideological purity. And that involves targeting and canceling people who refuse to relent. In his book Rules for Radicals, Saul Alinsky, well-known Marxist community organizer, wrote, "A reformation means that masses of our people have reached the point of disillusionment with past ways and values. They don't know what will work, but they do know that the prevailing system is self-defeating, frustrating, and hopeless. They don't act for change, but won't strongly oppose those who do. The time is then ripe for revolution. Remember, once you organize people around something as commonly agreed upon as pollution, then an organized people are on the move. From there, it's a short and natural step to political pollution, to Pentagon pollution." The media have played a huge role in dispiriting the public and undermining American traditions and institutions. And by Alinsky's measure, the revolution is now upon us. Among other things, his tactics must now be deployed, and they include picking the target, freezing it, personalizing it, and polarizing it. Alinsky continued, "In conflict tactics, there are certain rules that the organizer should always regard as universalities. One is that the opposition must be singled out as the target and frozen. Obviously, there is no point to tactics unless one has a target upon which to center the attacks. With this focus comes a polarization. As we have indicated before, all issues must be polarized if action is to follow." On January 2, 2019, Chuck Todd, the host of NBC's Meet the Press, provided a stark example of things to come. He openly issued a declaration to the nation that incorporated and combined all the worst practices and tactics discussed earlier. And it should have rattled every person who cares about freedom of speech and the legitimate competition of ideas as bulwarks of our country. Todd announced, "This morning we're going to do something we don't often get to do, dive in on one topic. It's obviously extraordinarily difficult to do this, as the end of this year has proven in the era of Trump. But we're going to take an in-depth look, regardless of that, at a literally earth-changing subject that doesn't get talked about this thoroughly on television news, at least. Climate change. But just as important as what we are going to do this hour is what we're not going to do. We're not going to debate climate change, the existence of it. The earth is getting hotter, and human activity is a major cause, period. We're not going to give time to climate deniers. The science is settled, even if political opinion is not. And we're not going to confuse weather with climate. A heat wave is not more evidence that climate change exists than a blizzard means that it doesn't, unless the blizzard hits Miami. We do have a panel of experts with us today to help us understand the science and consequences of climate change, and yes, ideas to break the political paralysis over it. There are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of experts and scholars who have challenged the view that the Earth is warming, or that it is warming due to man's activities, or that it may be warming but not to the extent that alarmists are claiming, or that it is warming to some extent but due to the sun or matters out of our control, etc. Todd dismisses them all as deniers and refuses them a national platform from which they can share their informed knowledge with the public or engage in debate on the subject. Of course, Todd does so even though he has no expertise. He is motivated by his allegiance to the climate change movement and insists on fronting for it. Obviously, he is not alone. In fact, you would be hard-pressed to find experts and scientists who challenge the climate change narrative appearing on television news programs or providing input in published news stories. But the storylines and guests promoting it are endless. The identical situation applies to critical race theory and related movements. As Zach Goldberg demonstrated in Tablet Magazine, countless articles have been published, often under the guise of straight news reporting, in which journalists take for granted the legitimacy of novel theories about race and identity. Such articles illustrate a prevailing new political morality on questions of race and justice that has taken power at the New York Times and the Washington Post, a worldview sometimes abbreviated as wokeness that combines the sensibilities of highly educated and hyper-liberal white professionals with elements of black nationalism and academic critical race theory. For some Americans, writes Goldberg, all of this is surely good news. For them, the rapid proliferation of articles employing the tropes of critical race theory to ascribe racial guilt in the American system represents a reckoning with white supremacy and inequality that is long overdue. There are many possible objections to this line of argument. To start, there's the fact that dividing a diverse, multi-ethnic society into oppressed and oppressor categories on the basis of skin color has, as a matter of historical precedent, more often led to sectarian bloodshed than enhanced justice and equity. What's more, the narratives promoting this new system of racial division are both factually fraudulent, built on false or misleading premises and assumptions, and deeply hostile to any attempts at factual correction. If one points out, for instance, that accounts of white supremacy as an all-powerful force in American society tend to discount that some non-white groups like Nigerian Americans, Indian Americans, and East Asian Americans all have more income equity than the average white person, this itself is invalidated as a racist microaggression. The media has actively promoted a theory of racism that misrepresents facts about the world while stigmatizing any effort to criticize those facts as racist. Consequently, the media have joined the critical race activists once dismissed as advocates for a radical and fringe movement, and the horrendous racism and demonization they represent and espouse in enthusiastically advocating for their Marxist-centric transmutation of American society. While Goldberg acknowledges inequities in American society, he also is repulsed by the steamrolling on suppressing inconvenient facts by those who seek to transform our country. What the data presented suggests is that editorial decisions made over the past decade at some of the most powerful media outlets in the world about what kind of language to use and what kind of stories merited coverage when it came to race, whatever the intention and level of forethought behind such decisions, has stoked a revival of racial consciousness among their readers. Intentionally or not, by introducing and then constantly repeating a set of key words and concepts, publications like the New York Times have helped normalize among their readership the belief that color is the defining attribute of other human beings. For those who adopt this singular focus on race, a racialized view of the world becomes baseline test of political loyalty. It requires adherence to overlook the immense diversity among so-called people of color and people not of color, that is, whoever is being lumped together as white according to the prevailing ideological fashion. In doing so, it has made stereotypes socially acceptable, if not laudable. Of course, the Times propaganda is intentional. As discussed earlier, it is the same media corporation aggressively promoting the discredited 1619 Project, which is being broadly distributed throughout the country's public school system, and as discussed, has as its purpose brainwashing students to believe that America, from its birth, was and is an irredeemably racist and oppressive society. Goldberg explains that the same media institutions that have promoted revisionist identitarianism and the radical transformation of American society along racial lines could instead have focused their attention and influence on improving the quality of life for all. Not surprisingly, CNN is all in. CNN's CEO, Jeff Zucker, announced the expansion of its beat covering race with plans for several new positions. Delano Massey will lead the beat, and the network is creating new positions for a senior editor, senior writer, and breaking and trends writer. This team will break news and cover the stories and conversations around race, Zucker wrote in a memo. The struggles, progress, and triumphs, the systemic racism that the majority of Americans now acknowledge exists, the latest polls and studies and data, how race is intertwined with inequality in business, politics, sports, media, housing, healthcare, and education, lack of representation and leadership roles in so many industries, the still present signals and symbols of racism, voices who provide solutions, inspiration, and leadership, Black, white, Latino, Asian American, Native American, multiracial, and all races. Gone are the days when the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. declared, "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." Having laid the foundation for revolutionary change in multiple areas of our society and culture, the banning, canceling, and silencing have begun in earnest. Repression, not engagement, compliance, not speech, conformity, not independence, and subjugation, not liberty, are all hallmarks of American Marxism. Writing in the City Journal, Robert Henderson explains in his essay Tell Only Lies that it is no longer enough to be ideologically pure by current standards. One must always have held the proper beliefs. Of course, such torturous moral standards can only lead to lying. In a recent paper titled Keeping Your Mouth Shut, Spiraling Self-Censorship in the United States, political scientists James L. Gibson and Joseph L. Sutherland reveal that self-censorship among Americans has soared. In the 1950s, at the height of McCarthyism, 13.4% of Americans reported that they felt less free to speak their mind than they used to. In 1987, the figure reached 20%. By 2019, 40% of Americans reported that they did not feel free to speak their minds. What are the consequences of this continuous self-censorship? Asks Henderson. He notes that in his book, The Great Terror, the British historian Robert Conquest suggests one possible answer. In a passage about Soviet show trials, Conquest was troubled by something. Why did innocent people falsely confess to appalling crimes even when most Soviet citizens themselves did not believe these people when they confessed. Conquest offers a chilling answer. Soviet citizens grew so used to lying that expressing one more falsehood was no big deal. People grew conditioned to accept the ever-changing standards and even affirm support for them. Moreover, Henderson notes that management expert Jerry B. Harvey describes situations in which individuals disagree with an idea but acquiesce out of a perception that others agree with it. If honesty becomes unfashionable, we operate under the assumption that others hold certain opinions which, in fact, they do not. Henderson warns, as the rules of the game keep shifting and individuals lose jobs or prominence because of things that they have said in the past, we will all become more adept at expressing falsehoods. It is likely that such a system will select for individuals predisposed to being comfortable with deception. Over time, only liars will speak openly. America's colleges and universities are among the most intolerant environments for administrators, faculty, and students alike who dare to cross any of the various intersecting Marxist movements that dominate on campus. Indeed, academic freedom and free speech, once considered foundations of higher education, are no more. The intolerance and cancel culture have spread to outright discrimination in hiring, promotion, grants, and publication of professors and graduate students who do not abide the ideology demanded by the campus revolutionaries. A March 1, 2021 study by Eric Kaufman of the Center for the Study of Partisanship and Ideology found, among other things, over 4 in 10 U.S. and Canadian academics would not hire a Trump supporter. Only 1 in 10 academics support firing controversial professors. Nonetheless, while most do not back cancellation, many are not opposed to it, remaining noncommittal. Right-leaning academics experience a high level of institutional authoritarianism and peer pressure. In the U.S., over a third of conservative academics and Ph.D. students have been threatened with disciplinary action for their views, while 70% of conservative academics report a hostile departmental climate for their beliefs. In the social sciences and humanities, over 9 in 10 Trump-supporting academics say they would not feel comfortable expressing their views to a colleague. More than half of North American and British conservative academics admit self-censoring in research and teaching. Younger academics and PhD students, especially in the United States, are significantly more willing than older academics to support dismissing controversial scholars from their posts, indicating that the problem of progressive authoritarianism is likely to get worse in the coming years. And a hostile climate plays a part in deterring conservative graduate students from pursuing careers in academia. A large study of student attitudes toward free speech in 2017 by the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education found, in part, 46% of students recognize that hate speech is protected by the First Amendment, and 48% of students think the First Amendment should not protect hate speech. 58% of college students think it's important to be part of a campus community where they are not exposed to intolerant or offensive ideas. In class, 30% of students have self-censored because they thought their words would be offensive to others. A majority of students, 54%, report self-censoring in the classroom at some point since the beginning of college. Unfortunately, taxpayer-funded elementary and secondary public schools have not escaped the politicization of thought and learning. In fact, they are now the target of such authoritarian efforts. Diane Ravitch, a historian, education policy expert, and professor at New York University, in 2004 wrote in her book, The Language Police, "Like others who are involved in education, I had always assumed that textbooks were based on careful research and designed to help children learn something valuable. I thought that tests were designed to assess whether they had learned it. What I did not realize was that educational materials are now governed by an intricate set of rules to screen out language and topics that might be considered controversial or offensive. Some of this censorship is trivial, some is ludicrous, and some is breathtaking in its power to dumb down what children learn in school. Initially, these practices began with the intention of identifying and excluding any conscious or implicit statements of bias against African Americans, other racial or ethnic minorities, and females, whether in tests or textbooks, especially any statements that demeaned members of these groups. These efforts were entirely reasonable and justified. However, what began with admirable intentions evolved into a surprisingly broad and increasingly bizarre policy of censorship that has gone far beyond its original scope and now excises from tests and textbooks words, images, passages, and ideas that no reasonable person would consider biased in the usual meaning of the term. As Ravitch rightly declares, censorship distorts the literature curriculum, substituting political judgments for aesthetic ones. Because of the bias and social content guidelines, editors of literature anthologies must pay more attention to having the correct count of gender groups and ethnic groups among their characters, authors, and illustrations than they do to the literary quality of the selections. Today, matters are far worse. Children in classrooms throughout America are being indoctrinated with critical race theory, CRT. White children are taught that they were born privileged and advantaged, and students study lessons prepared by the disgraceful New York Times 1619 Project. Black Lives Matter, an openly Marxist and often violent organization that actively seeks the elimination of capitalism and the American governing system, is celebrated. Moreover, in school district after school district, teachers are being trained to confront their white privilege and taught to refocus their knowledge of history to accommodate CRT. One need only scan the internet for endless examples. Students and teachers are being forced to spend time on other intersectional ideologies and their politics, including gender identity and gender rights. Consequently, in many areas of the country and growing, American history, the civil society, and for many, familial ethnicities, ancestries, and religious faith are being dishonored and degraded. Education is being infused with a Marxist-oriented, extremely divisive, racist, and intersectional ideology where teachers and students alike are compelled to participate in and embrace their own indoctrination. And there is more. The One UN Climate Change Learning Partnership, also known as UNCC Learn, is a collaborative initiative of 36 multilateral organizations working together to help countries build the knowledge and skills they need to take action on climate change, including better climate literacy and other crucial skills to tackle this challenge. It produces learning materials and advice encouraging schools to indoctrinate children into the climate change movement. For example, in one instructional guide titled, Why Should Schools Teach Climate Education?, the organization states, climate change education provides an important window into individual and societal responsibility. As educators, schools not only have an interest in teaching subjects that will prepare students for careers and earn them good test scores, but to teach them to be mindful citizens. Teaching on climate change means teaching on topics like environmental stewardship and collective responsibility, teaching students that they and those around them have a responsibility to something larger than themselves. How do their actions affect the environment? How do changes in the environment then affect others? Why should they care about recycling or sustainability? The guidance continues in its promotion of globalism, communalism, and activism. Climate change asks us to consider the world beyond ourselves. More than that, it asks that we consider a time beyond the present. Incorporating the topic into school curriculum only stands to bring students closer to their communities. Civic engagement, one of the most important lessons schools impart on their students, can be taught through student engagement with local institutions. How are their communities working to be more sustainable? What policies are governments putting in place, and how might students push for more? It is not enough to simply teach students about the science behind climate change. Students also need to learn how institutions and individuals deal with problems of this scale, and how they fit into that larger picture. As long as schools have a responsibility to teach global citizenship and community stewardship, They have reason to teach about climate change. The ideological indoctrination and conversely censorship have spread well beyond formal educational institutions and the subjects of race and climate change to corporate America. New York Post business columnist Charles Gasparino, writing about how corporations surrender to hard left wokeness, explains that companies used to be in business to make money, sell stuff, and employ people. They were run by executives who were proudly capitalist and believed in the country's founding principles. No longer, it seems. Big business's support of green energy legislation, various social justice edicts, and the silencing of right-wingers on Twitter have become so routine it's almost not news anymore. Gasparino adds, the left-wing forces have assembled to transform corporate America into something resembling the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. The left might hate capitalism, but it has been busy implementing capitalist tools to bend big business to its will. And Gasparino notes that it is working. Most shareholder votes now involve progressive edicts under the guise of so-called environmental social governance investing. ESG, as it is known on Wall Street, is a way to measure everything from a firm's compliance with green energy initiatives to its embrace of causes such as Black Lives Matter. Moreover, the average retail investors and mutual funds have no say or vote in this vast transformation, even as their money is being used for political purposes. The fund is responding to the vocal minority that figured out how the game is played. Indeed, a reign of ideological terror has spread throughout our society and culture, canceling and banning people, professors, teachers, writers, actors, executives, reporters, etc., historic figures, monuments, movies, television shows, radio broadcasts, books, cartoons, toys, other products, product names and brands, and even words. Even President Trump was banned from Twitter, Facebook, and alternative social media communication platforms. The list is so long and growing so fast as to make an up-to-date compilation impossible. So egregiously threatening to our country is this noxious and widespread war on free speech and liberty, and so quickly is it transforming American society, that on July 7, 2020, 150 mostly left-wing authors penned a public letter in Harper's Magazine, titled, A Letter on Justice and Open Debate. Although the signatories, among them Noam Chomsky, share many, if not most, of the goals of the various Marxist-oriented movements, and some have influenced the thinking of certain of its most radical activists, they apparently also realize that unleashed tyranny is difficult, if not impossible, to manage, and may inevitably devour many of its architects, proponents, and admirers. Witness the aftermath of the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and China's Communist Revolution. Their letter states in part, the free exchange of information and ideas, the lifeblood of a liberal society, is daily becoming more constricted. While we have come to expect this on the radical right, censoriousness is also spreading more widely in our culture. An intolerance of opposing views, a vogue for public shaming and ostracism, and the tendency to dissolve complex policy issues in a blinding moral certainty. We uphold the value of robust and even caustic counter-speech from all quarters, but it is now all too common to hear calls for swift and severe retribution in response to perceived transgressions of speech and thought. More troubling still, institutional leaders in a spirit of panicked damage control are delivering hasty and disproportionate punishments instead of considered reforms. Editors are fired for running controversial pieces. Books are withdrawn for alleged inauthenticity. Journalists are barred from writing on certain topics. Professors are investigated for quoting works of literature in class. A researcher is fired for circulating a peer-reviewed academic study. And the heads of organizations are ousted for what are sometimes just clumsy mistakes. Whatever the arguments around each particular incident, the result has been to steadily narrow the boundaries of what can be said without the threat of reprisal. We are already paying the price in greater risk aversion among writers, artists, and journalists who fear for their livelihoods if they depart from the consensus or even lack sufficient zeal in agreement. This stifling atmosphere will ultimately harm the most vital causes of our time. The restriction of debate, whether by a repressive government or an intolerant society, invariably hurts those who lack power and makes everyone less capable of democratic participation. The way to defeat bad ideas is by exposure, argument, and persuasion, not by trying to silence or wish them away. We refuse any false choice between justice and freedom, which cannot exist without each other. As writers, we need a culture that leaves us room for experimentation, risk-taking, and even mistakes. We need to preserve the possibility of good faith disagreement without dire professional consequences. If we won't defend the very thing on which our work depends, we shouldn't expect the public or the state to defend it for us. One wonders how many of the signatories have supported Marxist movements like Black Lives Matter. Nonetheless, their letter has fallen on deef ears. Indeed, since July 7, 2020, speech has come under an even more aggressive, withering attack. For example, big tech, including Google, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, and Twitter, are censoring and banning at will, using one pretext after another. Again, the instances are so numerous and mounting by the day that listing them here is undoable. Nonetheless, some prominent examples are illustrative. First, as reported by the Media Research Center, MRC, during one of several Senate hearings into big tech bias in 2020, even the CEOs of Facebook and Twitter could not name a single high-profile leftist person or entity that had been censored on their platforms when asked. Moreover, heavily censored themes included anything related to the election, COVID-19, and the response to it and statements released by President Donald Trump. However, big tech even found reasons to censor conservatives over things as innocuous as a children's book celebrating women's suffrage. MRC assembled a 2020 top 10 list demonstrating the various offenses that caused them to sanction free speech. 1. Big tech shuts down New York Post's bombshell reporting on Hunter Biden. 2. Twitter censors Trump tweet about mail-in voting in unprecedented manner. 3. Candace Owens' Facebook page is demonetized and suppressed. 4. YouTube removes COVID video featuring Trump advisor Dr. Scott Atlas. 5. Facebook demonetizes the satirical site The Babylon Bee page over Monty Python joke. 6. Twitter removes all instances of Joe Biden meme. 7. Instagram removes FBI crime statistics, calling them hate speech. 8. YouTube removes video featuring man who reversed his transgender surgery. 9. YouTube suspends and demonetizes conservative news network One America News, OAN. 10. Instagram bans ads for Senator Marsha Blackburn's children's book. On January 31, 2021, Project Veritas released a video it received from a Facebook insider where CEO Mark Zuckerberg and other top executives discussed the company's wide-ranging powers to censor political speech and promote partisan objectives. In the January 7th video, Zuckerberg is seen accusing then-President Trump of subverting the republic. "It's so important that our political leaders lead by example. Make sure we put the nation first here, and what we've seen is that the president, Trump, has been doing the opposite of that. The president, Trump, intends to use his remaining time in office to undermine the peaceful and lawful transition of power. His, Trump's, decision to use his platform to condone rather than condemn the actions of his supporters in the Capitol, I think, has rightly bothered and disturbed people in the U.S. and around the world." Zuckerberg also insinuated that Capitol protesters received better treatment than Black Lives Matter protesters. "I know this is just a very difficult moment for a lot of us here, and especially our Black colleagues. It was troubling to see how people in this capital mob were treated compared to the stark contrast we saw during protests earlier this past year. Guy Rosen, Facebook's vice president of integrity, described how the platform targets speech it deems dangerous. "We have a system that is able to freeze commenting on threads in cases where our systems are detecting that there may be a thread that has hate speech or violence. These are all things we've built over the past 3 to 4 years as part of our investments into the integrity space, our efforts to protect the election." Zuckerberg praised Biden and his political agenda. "I thought President Biden's inaugural address was very good. In his first day, President Biden already issued a number of executive orders on areas that we as a company care quite deeply about and have for some time," Zuckerberg said. Zuckerberg continued, "Areas like immigration, preserving DACA, ending restrictions on travel from Muslim-majority countries, as well as other executive orders on climate and advancing racial justice and equity. I think these were all important and positive steps." In the same January 21st meeting, Facebook's head of global affairs, Nick Clegg, addressed the international backlash that resulted from then-President Trump's suspension from the platform. "There has been quite a lot of disquiet expressed by many leaders around the world, from the President of Mexico to Alexei Navalny in Russia and Chancellor Angela Merkel and others, saying, well, this shows that private companies have got too much power. We agree with that. Ideally, we wouldn't be making these decisions on our own. We would be making these decisions in line with our own conformity, with democratically agreed rules and principles. At the moment, those democratically agreed rules don't exist. We still have to make decisions in real time." Facebook's vice president of civil rights, Roy Austin, said that the company's products should reflect their views on race. "I wonder whether or not we can use Oculus to help a white police officer to understand what it feels like to be a young black man who's stopped and searched and arrested by the police. I want every major decision to run through a civil rights lens." One reason given by big tech executives for censoring and banning speech on the internet is the rise of hate crimes. However, a report prepared for and provided to Congress by the Commerce Department's National Telecommunications and Information Administration, NTIA, in January, the role of telecommunications in hate crimes, but incredibly withheld from the public, concludes that the internet did not lead to more hate crimes and that big tech is operating perilously like a tyrannical oligarch. A copy of the report, which was provided to Breitbart News, emphatically concludes that the evidence does not show that during the last decade, a time of expansive growth of electronic communications, particularly on the internet and mobile devices, as well as social media, there has been a rise in hate crime incidents. The NTIA's report also issues a sharp warning. "We caution that efforts to control or monitor online speech, even for the worthy goal of reducing crime, present serious First Amendment concerns and run counter to our nation's dedication to free expression." The NTIA strongly admonishes big tech against its tyrannical practices. "Tech leaders have recognized that relying on human teams alone to review content will not be enough, and that artificial intelligence will have to play a significant role. That said, there are, of course, significant policy and practical limitations to reliance on automated content moderation. Interestingly, much of this technology is being developed from approaches pioneered by the Chinese Communist Party to stifle political discussion and dissent." The report goes on, "Given that all the major social media platforms have rules against hate speech and, in fact, employ sophisticated algorithmic artificial intelligence, AI, approaches to enforce these often vague and contradictory rules in a manner also used by tyrannous regimes, it is appropriate to ask what they gain from it. Certainly, as this report shows, the platforms have no reasonable expectation that their censorship will end hate crimes or even diminish it, as no empirical evidence exists linking increased hate speech with hate crimes. Further, this censorship poses real dangers to our political system. Under the hate speech prohibitions and other censorship rules, the platforms have removed content that many consider seriously engaged with pressing political and social issues. No doubt the NTIA will be ignored. That is the nature of ideologically driven decision-making. In fact, at a Senate hearing in November 2020, the Democrats on the committee demanded that big tech do more and faster to silence speech on their platforms. Big tech also went to extraordinary lengths to try to destroy a small entrepreneurial company, Parler, which was quickly gaining a following of millions of citizens who mostly did not share the ideological bias, political partisanship, and censorship practices of these huge multi-billion-dollar global companies. As the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette put it, the social media site Parler has been suspended from Google's and Apple's app stores, and Amazon has stopped providing the company with cloud services, effectively killing the service and prompting Parler to launch a federal lawsuit against the tech giant. The killing of Parler amounts to a chilling assault on speech. Social media, like much of the news media, has become a wedge between Americans who are decamping to different platforms along ideological lines in the tens of thousands in the wake of the bans. That cannot be a good thing for the country. Parler has fought its way back, but the collusive and monopolistic acts of big tech to destroy an independent platform were an extraordinary act of tyranny, and many in the media, unlike the Post-Gazette, were either silent or supportive of big tech's action, constantly referring to Parler as a platform for right-wingers, white supremacists, violent conspirators, and the like, all of which was untrue. Big tech's ideological and political preferences can also be established by examining the political donations of their executives and employees, and which candidates and party they subsidize and invest in. The picture could not be clearer. The Center for Responsive Politics reports that employees at big tech giants, including Alphabet, Google's parent, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, and Microsoft, donated millions to various Democrats' campaigns in the 2020 election cycle. Employees at the five companies shelled out a combined $12.3 million to Biden's campaign and millions more to Democrats in high-profile Senate contests, such as recently elected John Ossoff, Democrat of Georgia, and Raphael Warnock, Democrat of Georgia. Employees of big tech firms ranked among the top donors to each of those Democrats. With most donations coming from company employees, Alphabet contributed around $21 million to Democrats in the 2020 election cycle, with Amazon contributing around $9.4 million. Facebook, Microsoft, and Apple contributed about $6 million, $12.7 million, and $6.6 million to Democrats, respectively. The majority of each of the big tech firms' contributions went to Democratic candidates, and excluding Microsoft, the Biden campaign was the top recipient, with Ossoff and Warnock ranking in the top 10. Microsoft's top recipient for contributions was the Senate Majority PAC, the super PAC affiliated with Democratic Senate leader Chuck Schumer. The Democratic National Committee ranked in the top three recipients for all of the companies. CNBC reported, of current CEOs at large-cap tech companies, Netflix's Reed Hastings opened his wallet the widest. Hastings and his wife, Patty Quillen, donated more than $5 million. The biggest chunk went to the Senate Majority PAC, a group backing Democratic candidates in the closet races like in Maine, Texas, and Iowa. Between funds to campaigns and outside groups, employees from internet companies committed 98% of their contributions to Democrats, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. And then there is the incestuous relationship between the Biden administration and big tech, in which Biden rewarded big tech companies by hiring at least 14 current and former executives from Apple, Google, Amazon, Twitter, and Facebook to serve in his transition team and administration. The Democratic Party, not merely its surrogates, is playing a major and direct role in promoting censorship and repression. In November 2020, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York, posted on Twitter, Is anyone archiving these Trump sycophants for when they try to downplay or deny their complicity in the future? I foresee decent probability of many deleted tweets, writings, photos in the future. Encouraged by her declaration, a group called the Trump Accountability Project was formed. The group declared, "Remember what they did. We should not allow the following groups of people to profit from their experience: those who elected him, those who staffed his government, those who funded him." Indeed, there was much talk on social media and the media generally about blacklisting Trump administration officials and Trump supporters and preventing them from finding work in the private sector. Former First Lady Michelle Obama posted a statement on Twitter after rioters overran the Capitol building, demanding that Trump be banned from all social platforms for life. Needless to say, there were numerous others in public office or public positions who did the same, and big tech complied. Perhaps the most chilling and blatant example of the war on speech is a February 22, 2021 letter sent from two senior California House Democrats, Anna Eshoo and Jerry McNerney, to the chief executives of AT&T, Verizon, Roku, Amazon, Apple, Comcast, Charter, Dish, Cox, Altice, Hulu, and Alphabet, demanding to know why Fox News, Fox, One American News Network, OANN, and Newsmax are carried on these corporations' platforms. The companies received essentially the same letter. The congresspeople include a long list of sources which are mostly partisan studies and articles. I will focus on the letter sent to AT&T. The congresspeople wrote, "Misinformation on TV has led to our current polluted information environment that radicalizes individuals to commit seditious acts and rejects public health best practices, among other issues in our public discourse. Experts have noted that the right-wing media ecosystem is much more susceptible to disinformation, lies, and half-truths. Right-wing media outlets like Newsmax, One America News Network, and Fox News all aired misinformation about the November 2020 elections. Fox News has spent years spewing misinformation about American politics. These same networks also have been key vectors of spreading misinformation related to the pandemic. A media watchdog found over 250 cases of COVID-19 misinformation on Fox News in just a 5-day period, and economists demonstrated that Fox News had a demonstrable impact on non-compliance with public health guidelines." The congresspeople failed to mention that the media watchdog is the notoriously dishonest Media Matters, a radical left-wing pro-Democrat site. The Daily Caller found that they did not provide the methodology used to establish each instance of what it identified as Fox News misinformation for independent review. It further concluded that the report itself was filled with misinformation. The congresspeople demanded that AT&T and the other companies provide them in about 2 weeks' time the following information, in part: what moral or ethical principles, including those related to journalistic integrity, violence, medical information, and public health, do you apply in deciding which channels to carry or when to take adverse actions against a channel? Do you require, through contracts or otherwise, that the channels you carry abide by any content guidelines? If so, please provide a copy of the guidelines. What steps did you take prior to, on, and following the November 3, 2020 elections and the January 6, 2021 attacks to monitor, respond to, and reduce the spread of disinformation, including encouragement or incitement of violence by channels your company disseminates to millions of Americans? Please describe each step that you took and when it was taken. Have you ever taken any actions against a channel for using your platform to disseminate any disinformation? If yes, please describe each action and when it was taken. Are you planning to continue carrying Fox News, Newsmax, and OANN, both now and beyond any contract renewal date? If so, why? This is an extraordinarily appalling letter intended to intimidate and threaten targeted center-right broadcast and media organizations for the sole purpose of silencing their speech. and virtually none of the other media and news organizations wrote or spoke against it. The reason? They agree with it. Even more, many news groups, journalists, and opinion writers were the first to propose deplatforming Fox, OANN, and Newsmax, and are campaigning for government regulators and these platform companies to shut them down, as with Parler. Which brings me back to the American media, where I started this chapter. The intersectional movements that form the core of American Marxism are largely supported by the Democratic Party and promoted by the media. Of this, there can no longer be any doubt. Therefore, speech, debate, and challenges to Marxist-centric ideas are not tolerated. The purpose is societal and economic transformation. The means are social advocacy and activism. Opposition must be denounced, besmirched, and crushed. In fact, it is now obvious that the letter to these various corporations resulted from media demands for deplatforming Fox, OANN, and Newsmax, which preceded the letter's date. On January 8, 2021, CNN's Oliver Darcy wrote, "What about TV companies that provide platforms to networks such as Newsmax, One America News, and yes, Fox News? Somehow these companies have escaped scrutiny and entirely dodged this conversation. That should not be the case anymore. After Wednesday's January 6, 2021 incident of domestic terrorism on Capitol Hill, it is time TV carriers face questions for lending their platforms to dishonest companies that profit off of disinformation and conspiracy theories. After all, it was the very lies that Fox, Newsmax, and OAN spread that helped prime President Trump's supporters into not believing the truth, that he lost an honest and fair election." Yes, Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson and Mark Levin and others are responsible for the lies they peddle to their audiences. But the TV companies that beam them into millions of homes around the country also bear some responsibility. And yet, we rarely, if ever, talk about them. Notice Darcy's Alinsky tactics as he attempts to smear the cable networks and certain television hosts, including me. Pick the target, freeze it, personalize it, and polarize it. Neither the networks nor the hosts he mentions had anything whatsoever to do with the storming of the Capitol building. New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof picked up where Darcy left off, Alinsky tactics and all, and joined the deplatforming campaign. He wrote, "We can't impeach Fox or put Tucker Carlson or Sean Hannity on trial in the Senate, but there are steps we can take, imperfect, inadequate ones, resting on slippery slopes, to create accountability not only for Trump, but also for fellow travelers at Fox, OANN, Newsmax, and so on." Thus, Kristof demanded from his Times soapbox that we, the Marxist-like mob, must hold these non-conforming media outlets and hosts to account, that is, they must be silenced. Kristof continues, "That can mean pressure on advertisers to avoid underwriting extremists of any political bent, but the Fox News business model depends not so much on advertising as on cable subscription fees. So, a second step is to call on cable companies to drop Fox News from basic cable TV packages." In fact, Kristof's second step was obviously lifted from Media Matters. Next, Kristof frames his perverse tyrannical screed as protecting the consumer from having to fund Fox and, further, having to supposedly subsidize his biased and stereotypical description of its viewers as racist, violent, and anti-government. The issue here is that if you're like many Americans, you A, don't watch Fox News, and B, still subsidize Fox News. If you buy a basic cable package, you're forced to pay about $20 a year for Fox News. You may deplore bigots and promoters of insurrection, but you help pay their salaries. Kristof then cites Angelo Carasone, the radical ideologue and bigot who leads Media Matters, as an authority for his hit job against non-conforming media. Carasone says that Fox News relies on unusually generous cable fees, more than twice what CNN receives and five times what MSNBC commands. So Media Matters started a campaign for people to ask cable carriers to drop Fox News from their packages. Given all the damage that Fox News has caused and the threat that it remains, they absolutely should unbundle Fox News, Carasone told me. It's not a news channel, it's a propaganda operation mixed with political smut. If people want that, they should be forced to pay for it the way they pay for Cinemax. Margaret Sullivan, Washington Post, Max Boot, Washington Post, Brian Stetler, CNN, Anand Gerdadas, MSNBC, and numerous other reporters and columnists piled on with the same or similar propaganda and demands, and congressional Democrats, using their governmental pedestals and authority, seek to oblige them. From our schools and entertainment to the media and government, we are witnessing the onslaught of repressive actions, including threats, censorship, and character assassination, and the demand for more of it. Marx would approve. In fact, banning people, speech, words, broadcasts, and social media access, and redefining language, history, knowledge, and science, all of which are occurring or pursued in our current culture and environment, are the trademarks of totalitarianism. So too is the routine and unchallenged abuse of power and undermining of republicanism and constitutionalism by President Biden, who legislates via executive orders, thereby bypassing Congress and the Constitution's checks and balances to institute fundamental change to American society without input from the people's representatives in Congress or the people themselves. Or the efforts of Democratic Party congressional leaders, such as Speaker Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Schumer, to boldly threaten the independence of the judiciary in order to influence the outcome of legal decisions and to further their ideological and political agenda. And the collusive actions by the Democratic leadership in both elected branches of the federal government to radically alter the electoral process throughout the country to ensure the Democratic Party rarely, if ever, loses its power to rule. Plus, with the smallest majority in the House in decades and a tied Senate at 50-50 senators, they seek to stack the Senate with several additional Democrat seats and eliminate the filibuster rule, the purpose of which is to impose radical changes on the nation without broad support from representatives of other parts of the country. Yet it is the opponents of this tyranny who are labeled, often successfully, as the offenders of civil liberties and human rights, obstructors of progress, and foes of the people by the actual offenders. For the latter have already devoured most of the instrumentalities of the state and the culture and dominate the narrative. In his book, Double Talk, The Language of Communism, Harry Hodgkinson wrote, "Language was to Marx the direct reality of thought. Ideas do not exist divorced from it. And for Joseph Stalin, the reality of thought manifests itself in language. Words are tools as well as weapons, each fashioned for a precise function. The language of communism is not so much a means of explaining to an unbeliever what communism means, but an armory of weapons and tools intended to produce support or dissolve opposition to communist policies on the part of people either hostile or indifferent to them. The meaning of a communist word is not what you think it says, but what effect it is intended to produce." Moreover, writes Hodgkinson, to communists, a majority has no particular sanctity and is called upon to do not what it wishes, but its duty before the court of history. Choice between parties is a drab formality of bourgeois democracy. Democracy is generally used with a qualifying adjective. Hence, Marxist Senator Bernie Sanders uses the qualifying adjective democratic socialist. Even so, as Sanders knows, to the communist, such a phrase is no more than an essential stage on the road to communism. The wave of repression sweeping our nation is not unlike the earliest days of the French, Russian, and Chinese revolutions, among others. All were promoted as popular movements and people's revolutions intended to establish Rousseauian communalism or Marxist egalitarianism. But that is where the similarity ends. These revolutions were sold as liberation movements where the masses or the proletariat would rise up against the governing tyranny and corrupt society. They became genocidal police states. Of course, unlike these other governments and societies, America is a constitutional, representative republic, not a monarchy or other form of dictatorship. There is no widespread dissatisfaction in the country. In fact, most Americans are patriotic and revere the country. But the forces of false liberation today are led by fanatical ideologues and activists who are the real purveyors of tyranny and even totalitarianism. They use propaganda, sabotage, and subversion in an effort to demoralize, destabilize, and ultimately destroy the existing society and culture. It is they who are repressing the liberties of their fellow citizens through what is loosely called the cancel culture. It is they who demand conformity of thought by banning differing views from social media. It is they who use the false narrative of oppressors and oppressed to stigmatize those they claim as part of the white dominant culture and silence the voices of fellow citizens. It is they who are banning words, books, products, movies, and historical symbols. It is they who are destroying the careers of doubters and boycotting the businesses of nonconformists. It is they who are undermining academic freedom and intellectual curiosity through fear and intimidation. It is they who are distorting American history and brainwashing students. It is they who demand the deplatforming of cable news networks and the muzzling of hosts. And it is they who are using and promoting racism, sexism, ageism, etc. as weapons of disunity and rebellion while claiming to want to end them. Even worse, they are using America's freedom to destroy freedom and the Constitution to destroy the Constitution. And as their poison spreads throughout the culture, the intent is to sow doubt about the country, dispirit the citizenry, and soften the public's innate and reasoned resistance to the point of acquiescence to the tyranny of the Marxist-inspired and related domestic movements.